Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to another segment of New Books in Poetry. I am your host, Jen Fitzgerald. Today we have the honor of featuring a work in translation and of welcoming both the writer and translator to discuss the collection Caída Libre. Tina Escaja is a Spanish-American author and digital artist. She is currently... Welcome to another segment of New Books in Poetry. I am your host, Jen Fitzgerald. Today we have the honor of featuring a work in translation and of welcoming both the writer and translator to discuss the collection Caída Libre. Tina Escaja is a Spanish-American author and digital artist. She is currently a professor at the University of Vermont. She is an NEH grant recipient and a literary critic. Tina has published extensively on gender and contemporary Latin American and Spanish poetry and technology. Her digital art, video, and multimedia projects have been exhibited in museums and galleries internationally. She has written 4 notable books of poetry, including Caída Libre, which won the prestigious Dulce María Loynez International Poetry Prize. Her verse has been translated into 6 languages and has appeared in literary collections around the world. She has also written award-winning fiction and plays and is the author of experimental and hypertextual poetry. Tina has held leadership roles in several organizations and is currently the president of the Association of Spanish Professionals in America. Mark Eisner is an award-winning writer, translator, filmmaker, and president of the nonprofit Red Poppy, dedicated to promoting the power of Latin American poetry to foster social consciousness. Tina is its vice president. Under its auspices, the two edited an anthology of Latin American poetry in resistance, forthcoming from Mad Hat Press. Eisner was awarded high honors in English and creative writing as an undergrad at the University of Michigan. In 2000, he received a fellowship to earn a master's in Latin American studies from Stanford. They subsequently named him a visiting scholar to continue his scholarly and creative work on Pablo Neruda. City Lights published his highly acclaimed The Essential Neruda Selected Poems in 2004. On his centennial that year, Mark read Pablo's poetry to millions while being interviewed on NPR's Morning Edition. He has just finished a groundbreaking biography on Neruda. Work continues on a documentary film. A book of short stories having nothing to do with Neruda is next. Welcome, Tina and Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
So I would like to talk not only about Free Fall, but also speak in depth about the translation process. First, let's get to know about you two. How did you first meet?
Well, that's a great question. We met through a mutual friend, Todd Brown, and he was part of the Red Poppy project. Mark can explain that a little bit in San Francisco.
Okay. Yeah. Todd is an artist from Burlington, where he knew Tina, and we had met in San Francisco around 2002 or 3. He was starting up a what's now called the Red Poppy Art House, and we became good friends, and I started collaborating with him, and he put the two of us in touch, and it's just been an amazing friendship and collaboration, and just beautiful that it was through Todd and his creativity that kind of transcends it all in a little way, too.
In terms of this project, who approached whom?
I think it was kind of mutual, because I gave my friend one volume of the awarded book, Caída Libre, and the painter, my friend, he did actually kind of an homage to the book, creating a beautiful painting that included pages of the book. And Mark Eisner came to UVM to present his project on the film on Pablo Neruda, and he was kind enough to bring also this painting. So somehow Caída Libre was part of us from that moment as well. And I gave, of course, one volume to him, and he, Mark, liked it. And I'm very, very happy that he was interested in the translation.
I forgot about that. I literally carried it at each other from San Francisco to Burlington.
So, Tina, I imagine this is not the first time that your work has been translated, right?
Right.
So how do you decide if the person is going to be a good fit? Like, what do you look for in a translator?
Oh, well, this is a very difficult thing. I'm impressed by the texture of the person who is translating, of the words that this person is working with other translations first. In case of Mark, besides him being a very dear friend, I was also very much his way of translating the poems, some of the poems of Pablo Neruda. So that's my initial thing. I get really interested in the craft, in the ability to do exactly that, to translate from one language to the next and transferring the soul of the poem. So that's the main factor for me to make a decision on whether or not I would like to collaborate, because it's an act of collaboration, it's an act of a change. And also personalities matter as well. I mean, I think it's important that we can communicate and being able to respect the original work that, as you know, becomes something else in the moment that is already published. So it's also, it's work, it's hard. So you need to really have a good connection with the person and also to trust the skill. And that's my priority.
So let's hear some of the fruits of those labors, please. Would you please read, Tina, first in Spanish and then Mark the translation, The Record of Being, starting on page 4?
Sure.
Okay, let me get this. Yes.
Historial del ser. Determinar la causa. La ausencia exacta del momento. Cuando dejas de ser alguien y eres otra y te dibuja. Expande tu interior. Lo sodomiza. Primero el desencuentro. Los tibios labios corvos que succionan y no saben que más allá del esperma estás tú. Y se duplica, extravagante, avanza, retrocede, me posee esa otra nada, esa burbuja dos. Y no sé si llorar o consumir este último bocado a solas, pretendiendo esquivar la evidencia de mi sangre detenida. Sangre estancada, usurpadora, meretriz de instantes infinitos, interruptor arbitrario del no ser. Esa sangre mensual que me atestigua lunas, caballos siderales, orquestando mareas y espasmos del amor. Y yo procuro hacerlo, desentenderme toda, y especulo camillas de hospital, techos encalados y remordimientos. Entonces te ignoré, hundí mi pena y no fuiste. Ahora vuelves a entregarte toda y te me impones. Y en la curva de la distancia que separa tu sangre de la mía, acepto.
Mark, whenever you're ready.
Record of Being. To determine the cause, the moment's exact absence, when you stop being someone and you're another, and it draws you, expands your interior, sodomizes it. First the discord, the warm curved lips that suction, not knowing you're beyond the sperm. It duplicates extravagant, advances, recedes, the other not nothing possessing me, this doubled bubble. And I don't know whether to cry or consume this last bite alone, hoping to dodge the evidence of my arrested blood, stagnant blood, usurping, harlot of infinite instants, arbitrary interpreter of non-being, that monthly blood that affirms moons, sidereal horses, orchestrating tides and love spasms. And I try to do it, to have no part. I contemplate hospital beds, whitewashed roofs, remorses. I ignored you then. I'd buried my pain. You did not happen. Now you return to give yourself over, to impose yourself on me. And in the curve of the distance that separates your blood from mine, I consent.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Mark, what do you think is the primary responsibility of someone translating poetry?
I think there's an obligation to the translator, to the original work and the original poet, which brings out the huge challenge of translating, the art of translating. And that's that not only do you have to translate the inherent or original literal meaning of the original lines, but you also have to translate, transform the poetry, the beauty, the poetic substance of the original beauty. And that makes you have to balance both that literal and artistic license and interpretation. And finding that balance and finding the magic in between balancing that, or the very frustration of not being able to balance that, is I think what it's all about, or what it should be about.
Mm. What I have found when translators attempt to take something from the Romance languages and turn it into English, that I guess what we would consider prosody, they have more of a musicality. So, Tina, is the musicality of your poems as important as the content? And do you think that some of that is lost in translation?
Well, it's obviously there is... In my case, for example, for me, the internal rhythm and the way of the words is extremely important. So it's beyond not only the words in the page themselves and the content, but also what you say, the musicality, the tone of each word is extremely important. It's actually the basis of most of my poetry. So this is a huge challenge for the translator, obviously, because not being from a different language roots, it becomes particularly difficult. But I think it's accomplished by translators like Mark that are very skillful and able to go beyond the words and achieve that rhythm, that internal rhythm, that musicality. But definitely it's very, very hard. And I really think that in some poems, it resents a little bit that the lack of that pause, that particular pause that is very hard to be completely and absolutely translated, not just in terms of the content and the form itself of the words, but just that tone. So, yes, it's hard. It's hard.
So I would love to hear another piece, but let's switch up the reading. I'd love to hear Free Fall on page 43, one of the title poems. But Mark, would you read the translation, and Tina, would you then read the original?
Sure.
Free Fall and Mire. I sit fallen by the television that frightens the ghosts of things, of lark's nests. And the reflection keeps imposing your soul to form, that vestige of a nameless god, the god I yearn for, which you don't grant me. Adored friend, my daughter, gift me that god. Don't hide from me, for I have nothing left but the threshold of your kiss, but your round ring, but your soul to be made. Gift me your paradise, and I'll guard you from these endless broken sequences. From the city of prodigies and prostitutes, from the world of the dead, I promise to undo the harm and not cry in exchange for your God.
Caída libre y cieno.
caída quedo frente al televisor que espanta los fantasmas de las cosas reales, de los nidos de alondras. Y el reflejo sigue imponiendo tu alma por hacer, ese vestigio de un dios sin nombre, el dios que anhelo y que no me das. Amor amiga, hija mía, regálame ese dios. No te me escondas, porque nada más me queda que la puerta de tus besos, que tu anillo redondo, que tu alma por hacer. Regálame tu paraíso y te resguardo de este infinito de lentejuelas rotas, de esta ciudad de los prodigios y de las prostitutas, del mundo de los muertos. Te prometo deshacer el entuerto y no llorar a cambio de tu dios.
Thank you. Mark, what difficulties did you encounter during this translation process?
Actually, I was going to maybe want to touch back on this, and this goes into right into your question. One of the beauties of working on this, I had been working on especially Pablo Neruda, who died in 1973, the year I was born, where he's a poet who you can't be the collaboration that Tina was talking about that we had at the beginning. And it's just going back to some of what was said before about, have me being able to take certain, going with certain sounds and keeping that, that you have to balance the literal and the poetic, but you can't go past a certain limit, or you need to keep it within some kind of balance. And working with Tina, there was that ability to go back and forth, to sound out ideas, to say, does this work? Does this not work? What do you think of this? Can I say this? And so for me, there's her specific language is very presented some very interesting challenges, but at the same time, which I can mention, but at the same time, there is just such a thrill to be able to work with the original poet in such a good way that we collaborated so that we could really make it just so much more dynamic and feel that I was being honest to what the poet obviously would want.
And Tina, how did it feel when you got those first translations back from Mark and you saw it in English on the page? What is that feeling for you?
Well, I felt thrilled. I think it's I enjoyed it very much. It's like a creature that you have, and you have a special love for that particular book in this case, because this particular book was very painful for me to write, and it was a long and that pain is in the book as well. So it was a very long process, and I really wanted for a long time. I really wanted to have an English audience. So when Mark agreed to work with this, I was so thrilled and I was so happy. But at the same time, I was so distant at that point, because it has been a few years from the poems themselves, that for me were like foreign objects. So especially it was because it was something that I had written before, long time ago, within a special circumstances, but also it was in a different language, in English. So of course I was absolutely thrilled, but at the same time I was mesmerized by that distance.
I love that term, foreign objects, because I could imagine it being that, because they're obviously your words or your sentiments or your content, but you're reading them back in a language that transforms them and definitely shifts the meaning. So it's almost like you'd have to retranslate the English back into the Spanish.
Exactly. I feel exactly like that. Mm. True.
So for the final poem, let's end, fittingly, with The End of Time on page 143. Tina, would you read the original piece in Spanish, and then Mark, please read the translation?
Yes, of course. Final del tiempo, del juego, de las cosas que acaban y se deshacen como palomas sin rumbo. Final del mundo. Impredecible acierto de estrellas y fragmentos que escapan a tanta desazón. Es el fin, mi tesoro, que sonríes y elevas por encima de las copas y de los rascacielos.
este umbral sin mesura ni alimento, sin caricia ni hamaca. La bola del gigante neoyorquino se aventura en su paso simple, destella muchedumbres, regocijos. Es el fin y el comienzo, y expectantes asistimos al destino urbano y ocre de nuestro descalabro.
The end of time, of the game, of things that extinguish and tear apart like aimless doves. The end of the world, random triumph of stars and fragments escaping such great sorrow. It's the end, my darling girl, my treasure, who smiles and rises above the tree tops and the skyscrapers. This threshold void of restraint and nourishment, caress and hammock. Gigantic New York's New Year Eve's ball drops at its simple pace, sparkling, rejoicing crowds. It's the end and the beginning, and we anxiously await the urban okra fate of our havoc.
Thank you very much. There are some killer lines in this poem. And I would like to sit with the last line because it resonates. And we anxiously await the urban ochre fate of our havoc. It seems like a pretty direct translation from what I can understand. But is there meaning being translated, created, or lost with this line?
Are you asking me?
I guess I'm asking both of you. I mean,
yeah, because I think that it should be perhaps Mark, how he feels about this line.
How do you feel about this line, Mark?
I'd actually revisit it a little. I haven't looked at it for a while, but
I like it. I think it's beautiful. I like the I think it's, as you said, is very literal in terms of the content, but the use of the words are beautiful, in my opinion. I like that weight that I was mentioning before, the pace, the tone, the rhythm of those beautiful words, ochre, fate, havoc. So I think that is well established, the essence of that line, which is like a punchline at the end, the fact that it's the end and the beginning. So I think it's very well accomplished, this particular line.
Yeah, this one, there were many lines throughout the collection that surprised me, but this one surprised me the most, like almost so much where I like sat back in my chair. I was like, wait a second. Like, you're trying to wrap your mind around it, to conceptualize it, to imagine it, because the ochre fate of our havoc in context with the end of time and the beginning of time, I just think it's beautiful.
Thank you. I agree. Thank you also to Mark for this translation. And it has, it's kind of one of the essential parts of the book. I mean, the idea of apocalypse, in the sense that death and rebirth is a change of values that I am proposing in this book. So that at the end of the millennium. So that particular sentence or line, it really concentrates some of those meanings.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mark.
It's just, you know, one page before the kind of coda, which is about, you know, when you're going through this poem, which it's going through real world, real life events with both Tina and her pregnancy and what's going on in New York, and then boom, 9/11, which is the section that follows kind of as a appendix or a coda, that line, which makes it kind of even more abrupt when you go into the next section.
Yeah, I read the next section and I had wanted to maybe feature one of the pieces from there, but it would have been difficult to isolate one. Do you want to speak briefly about this appendix?
Yes. This happened a little bit after I finished the book, so that's why it's a coda, but it makes perfect sense within this idea that I'm
proposing of a change of values. And it's also a feminist book in many senses as well, you know, transformation of traditional values. But then there are the values of the Western values being reconsidered by what happened with 9/11. So I kind of delve into those ideas in these three parts of the fall of the skyscrapers. And I had to do with some personal anecdote related to my second child. And I thought that it was a good way to end the book because it stressed that component that I said of pain that is in the book, but at the same time, at the end, there is again a rebirth, a new possibility. So I thought it was coherent, but at the same time, it needed its own segment. And I think Mark did a good job because it's very much on the idea of falling. It's very experimental. Mm-hmm. And he did a good job transferring that sense of experimentation on the page with the words. So yes, that's pretty much in general my idea of this part. I don't know what Mark thinks about this.
What do you think, Mark?
No, I agree. I mean, I was doing this, actually translating this. I was living in southern Chile in a cabin, and a snow-capped volcano outside the window that was smoking. And it was just the context to go through this poem and then be there, you know, seeing her witness in the sense of the poet's eyes after everything in this epic poem, which it was already before you got to this. And then the true timing, you know, it was a little after the real life events, but, you know, basically this is almost this true real life epic with real time and real historic events. And it was just, it was just put me in this different world. But it was so, I was right there, not even because I was translating, even more so because I was translating, but it just kind of being that far away in such a different world than being in New York, you know, you could be anywhere. And it was just so transcendent in a way that it brought me right there, which was so much of the poem. And also, in a little bit, just to circle back around, just thinking of that the whole, when you asked me some of the challenges of translating this book, for me, not only this was the first book-length poem that I have done, which is definitely different than just doing two or three pages mm-hmm. of a, you know, poem that's two or three poems, pages, and then you go on. And that was a challenge. And then it also, you know, it took me a little bit out of my boundaries where, you know, I've never been pregnant or even had a there's just so much in this that shifted me and was whether it's there's a lot of raw corporal words and imagery and also just the thoughts and the insights that are foreign to me because I could never be in that position. Mm-hmm. Although I've had, you know, some friends, but never, you know, a true partner. And it was just to link through the translating process through words in a different language, through these different things I could never experience that were taking me out of the boundary. But yet in a way I had to put myself in Tina's shoes or pen or mind as being, you know, the translator of her poetry. It was just it was an awesome experience, and I couldn't have done it without Tina. So I also want, as I say that, I want to give a shout out to Katia Shefton, who kind of helped me on some of this too.
Good. So. Well, one of the things that of course made me enthusiastic about this book was that a man had translated the poetry of a woman, and that is very rare, from what I've come to understand, doing any type of tallying of gender. And it was heartwarming, for sure. So I have two questions for each of you. Tina, what advice can you offer to a poet who is about to have their work translated? And Mark, what advice can you offer to a translator who is about to translate their first collection?
This is a hard one.
I know.
I well, There are two things here. One is the fact that actually we want readership in a way, especially with people like us that are hybrid in so many ways. And we continue being part of this and not being part of this country and this language, especially as a poet that really lives and thrives in their own native language. So on the one hand, it is true that we want that readership. We want that opportunity to reach out and to have more readers in a country like this, that even though we have the second language, in particular with the Spanish, the second language is Spanish in this country, but then you don't have that many opportunities of publishing in Spanish. So one thing is, the truth is that we want that. And sometimes we are a little bit careless, perhaps, or some poets wouldn't be that selective because they cannot afford being selective in terms of who they want to choose as their translators. But once you have that opportunity, obviously, you need to be careful in the sense that you want to see what is the craft, what is the skill, because this is a very, very difficult trait to be translator. So pay attention to other translations and look for passion and for connection, which I was so lucky to have with Mark Eisner. He not only is a seasoned translator, but also he has the passion, and we had the connection. And then went beyond, because this is a very gender-based book in many, many ways, and at the same time, obviously, it's extremely universal. So, yes, that would be my recommendation, is to be open and to be patient in many ways, but also to be generous and to, if possible, to have a good connection, to be able to collaborate and make a nice product of your work.
That's great advice. What about you, Mark?
Well, I could almost use that same answer for the translator, or same advice for the translator. Definitely on the collaboration. The Neruda project, the Central Neruda, one of the main raison d'être, or I regret using that word, but the idea behind how that book was put about, which was a combination of about 7 different translators working with 3 or 4, at least in the end, kind of scholars or Nerudianos all over the world, and an editor or two in between, was that we couldn't collaborate with Neruda and ask him. But instead of that, we could have this collaboration as much as we could among each other. So as I couldn't call Tina, we could go through this process, and I think that's one of the reasons it turned out so well. There's a quote. We can skip that. But the other thing is, going back to kind of what I said at the beginning when you were talking about the challenges at the beginning, it's really, in terms of advice, it's I can't, obviously tell you how, but that to think of translation, if you're doing literary translation, you must think of it as an art. You must embrace it as an art and as a creative challenge. And it's that balancing again between, are you just keeping the literary meaning translated, or how much of that original poetry are you infusing, transcending, transforming into your translation, but yet keeping it in check. There's many examples of how one can just totally land it with a genius performance on the page, and in terms of something like Robert Haas did Neruda's poem 15, and it's an Alexandrine, which is a kind of a historic form, which Tina could go off on for 5 hours on the form of that. But it's got a certain meter and a certain rhythm, and nobody else. This is I Like It When You're Quiet, one of his more famous ones. And Robert Haas, former U.S. Poet Laureate, he, and just a saintly genius, a saint, he took the challenge of keeping it, the rhyme, intact. Or not the same rhyme, but keeping it rhymed and in the same meter. And so you lost a little of, if somebody's going to try to learn Spanish by reading translations and poetry, that if somebody's doing that, that should mean that and being successful in a way, that means that the translation really isn't that successful.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't do the 1+1=2 or whatever. And Bob was able to translate a poem and keep the original rhyme pattern and so close to the meaning, an inherent meaning, that it was just beautifully successful. And you had that poetry translated while still being within the limits of not going too overboard and putting in your whole other words, which some people do, and you know, making it an adaptation. And somewhere in there is something what Alistair Reed, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, he was Neruda's favorite translator, really. And he had said that, you know, translation is a process of moving closer and closer to the original, yet of never arriving.
Hmm.
And that's for the reader to cross the page.
Huh. Oh, I love that.
Yes.
Well, can you tell us something about the forthcoming anthology with Mad Hat?
Sure.
Sorry to switch gears on you like that, but I'm excited about this anthology.
I think we both would be happy to talk about it.
Yes.
You know, if you want, maybe talk about how it came about, and maybe I can say.
Oh, okay. Well, this is something we really wanted to do. We wanted to continue our collaboration also with Red Puppy, and we thought that it was important to tap into the need of a different sort of anthology. And I was also thinking in my own classes of literature at the University of Vermont that some, with the lack, there is a huge issue with the current anthologies, like, for example, don't cover, they are only primarily men being included in those anthologies, and also the classics, nothing really contemporary. In terms of Latin America, many countries were always dismissed, different languages also being dismissed, when, as you know, many, many languages are being spoken also in Latin America, so new voices in Maya, in Maya Quiche, in Miskito, in Quichua. And so I think that we wanted to do that. I mean, Mark and I have a very similar sense of interest and political interest in terms also of social justice, and we wanted to create this anthology, which is Poetry in Resistance, Poesía en Resistencia. Mm-hmm. So, and the beauty of this is that it covers all countries in Latin America, all different languages, and also resistance in terms of ecology, in terms of gender issues, in terms of radical issues, not just political issues in the traditional sense. So we wanted to also recover those voices that are contemporary, are very, very strong and very persuasive. Also many women that are not collected in contemporary or even traditional anthologies.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Mark? What can you say about compiling this anthology?
I'm very proud of this, and I'm very grateful to Mad Hat to take this on. I remember we've been working on this for a while now, and just in the beginning, you know, Tina's frustration of not having a text to teach these poems, this poetry, I'm not going to use the word canon, but something like that, in her class, and having to go from, a copy here and a copy there, and that there is no book. And so we were kind of like, well, why don't we make the book? And as Tina said, one of the great things is that, one of the things that we wanted with this book is that, you know, sure, you can get, books about, environmental issues in Latin America or anywhere, or feminists. But this puts, as she said, feminist, queer, indigenous, urban even, ecological themes, alongside the more historical prominent protests against imperialism, dictatorships, and, of course, economic equality. And we cover every Latin American country, which we thought was very important. So we've got 42 poems from 28 different countries. And we just did this actually this morning, this count, because we didn't plan this. But it turned out that without any arbitration or whatever, it turned out that there's 23 men and 19 women represented.
Not too shabby.
No. So it was really cool to see that, you know, it came right pretty much right down the middle. And
you and I had actually spoken about the difficulty that one might encounter when seeking out Latin American female poets to be included in such an anthology.
Right. And this is part of my critical work and scholarship. The fact that we have amazing, very powerful, very important Latin American female writers, however, they are not included in the canon, the so-called canon. So this is important because they deserve it. I mean, they are very important voices. And it's sad that it turns to be a difficulty when actually they are there and they are extraordinary. So that's the beauty of it, and looking also into these voices that are so important in the 21st century that were practically not recorded in the previous one, in the previous century. And we felt the responsibility of paying attention to these voices and these presences and these themes. So,
mm-hmm. When this anthology comes out, I invite you to return to New Books in Poetry and would love to feature some of the poets who are in there, and we can talk more about the process, because I think this is a necessary anthology, and I applaud your work on it.
Thank you.
And just one quick thing on that, I also want to say that we've got some amazing translators behind this. It's a multilingual anthology, as we like to call it, not just a bilingual. And everyone from our current amazing poet laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, to translators who are amazing but have never been published before. So just wanted to put in that, too.
Thank you. So for our final questions, I'd like to know from each of you who you are reading right now and what you are listening to.
Well, you know, Jen, this is so hard for me. As a professor, every day I'm reading canonical stuff. So right now we are working on Tres Tristes Tigres from Guillermo Cabrera Infante. So I don't really, really don't, at this point, I don't have the luxury of reading anything else. And I get really involved in during my classes. So unfortunately, I cannot really say more than that I'm reading the traditional writers, in this case from Cuba. Mm-hmm. And what am I listening to? That's a tricky one. I prefer Mark to answer.
Is it the answer for you?
Yes. I'll be here.
What about you, Mark?
Well, I actually have the modern luxury of just being able to switch to my iTunes here and see my recently played to give you an idea. And I've got a bunch of Grateful Dead and Fugazi, followed by that, Violeta Parra and Beck and Miles Davis then.
Wow.
Pretty diverse.
And I am, what's been great is that I finally finished this 10-year voyage on this biography on Neruda, which I just recently finished, and finished some other things and taking some breaks from some other things, and I'm finally able to actually sit down and read a novel through, which has been great. And I just finished Carolina de Robertis, mainly her The Gods of Tango, which I highly recommend. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading something I've been wanting to read for a long time, Michael Chabon's Telegraph Avenue. And then next on the list is, I believe it's Hot House, the book on Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been nice to read a novel where I've just been kind of limited between my, how much, because of the biography, it's been so much research too, that mm-hmm. I just have the mind space just to read some poems or a short story. And it's nice to just sit down and read a novel.
Yeah. Reading for pleasure is a game changer.
It really is.
I'll wait until the summer.
Well, I want to thank you, Tina and Mark, for coming on today and sharing a bit of your process and your work.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jen, and thank you for having this program.
This is Jen Fitzgerald with New Books in Poetry, reminding you to support all the arts, but especially poetry.